You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome once again to the Parish Council. It's the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw, and get up if you feel like being a sex machine, for it's my compadre, Terence de Com.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello, sir.
Welcome back.
Oh, thank
from
you.
Your travels,
yes,
abroad.
Yeah, I have been travelling abroad. Yes, I've been to, both coasts of the Florida Panhandle in the United States of America.
Why on earth do you do such a thing?
Because it's very hot, very sunny. When you order something in a diner, they bring you enough for a small family that they wish to make considerably larger. And I managed to bag myself a hotel room overlooking Disney World. So I could actually see parts of Disney World, and of course at 10 o'clock every night I got a free fireworks display.
That's splendid. Yeah. And why did you zip over to the other side of the Florida headland?
My brother-in-law has a timeshare over on the west coast, what they call the Gulf Coast, and so we blagged the nights there as well. Though the Gulf Coast is really beautiful. It's probably got the edge on the east coast, which they call the Space Coast. Although that's very nice too, but it's absolutely stunning over on the Gulf Coast. You know, white beaches, silica sand, blue sea, the temperature of bath water, almost nobody on the beach. Stupendous. Actually, whilst over on the Gulf Coast, have you ever seen a manatee?
I have not ever seen a manatee.
Do you know what a manatee is?
I'm not entirely sure. It's a sort of octopusy stingray thing, but I'm not too sure.
Yeah, because an octopus and a stingray are like really similar.
Absolutely. Brothers in arms.
No, it's nothing like a stingray and nothing like an octopus. If you imagine a small walrus with no tusks, although I say small, you know, it's about the size of a king-size bed, something like that, but it's a bit like a walrus with no tusks. And we saw a family of them swimming in the sea off the Gulf Coast. Really, really close to where we were on the beach. But when they are out there swimming, you're not allowed to go in the sea. The Coast Guard, well, not the Coast Guard, the lifeguard will come and grab you because you can't disturb the manatee when they're having their afternoon perambulation. But
and would they disturb you? Would they take a chunk out of a human, or are they friendly little
Well,
creatures?
No, quite the opposite. If you do happen to be in the sea on a beach where there is no lifeguard, they will come up to you and you can stroke them and feed them and stuff. On our beach there was a lifeguard and he brought everybody in when the manatee came, which is fair enough. Yeah, it's fair enough.
You spent some time waiting for the manatee. Little gag there for you.
Underground, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. When you were going from A to B across Florida, did you skim across the Everglades dodging alligators and indeed manatee, or did you fly? How do you get from one side of Florida to the other is my question.
Well, the Everglades aren't in central Florida.
You've got to destroy my vision.
There's a lot of swamp, but they're not technically.
I was picturing, you know, because I've always wanted to go on one of those kind of traveling machines with the great big fan blades going around.
Yes. Airboats. Yeah, you can't traverse Florida in one of those. I mean, apart from anything else, it would take you about 3.5 days to do that. Because they don't go as fast as you probably think they do, those airboats.
Really? Oh, I thought of them skimming across from one coast to the other like some latter-day Indiana Jones. So were you drove across or something? Did you?
Well, one coast to the other is about 200 miles, something like that. But we were a little inland, so it took us a bit quicker than that. So we drove over to the coast. But the amazing thing in Florida is you can look out of your car window, give yourself about 10, 15 minutes of close observation, and you will see a gator on the side of the road basking in the sun.
Oh, as long as they stay basking in the sun and not sort of taking a leap at your front tires, then.
You do live in a fantasy world, isn't it?
I do. I have this like little notional vision of Florida, you know, which is clearly way away from the reality.
Yeah, no, I can assure you, Florida gators have no ability to chase after cars.
That's really disappointing. You destroyed several sort of ideas I had in my mind life in Florida, zipping about on those air blade machines.
Well, all that exists. All that does exist. exist, but just not in the way you quite imagine it. But I did see a gator on the side of the road, which is always exciting. I saw some manatee. I also saw Disney World catch fire, which was quite interesting.
Good grief. That wasn't part of the display.
No.
It sets fire to itself every night at 9:45 before the fire.
No, it didn't. It was complete. Well, I say it was by accident. So the Florida police were reporting that they thought it was arson. But it was.
Are they looking for a Midlands based English?
Yeah, no. Yeah, they might well be, but they'll have to catch me first. There was actually the sort of wooded swamp area at the gates of Disney that was on fire on Thursday night, which was rather exciting. It was on the national news in the States, and we could see that. Well, it was about 2 miles from where we were, so we could see that clearly from our hotel room as well. So that was exciting.
Well, it didn't make the news over here. We were too busy with Justice Leveson and. Various other European issues.
Yeah, you don't want all that. You want a theme park on fire. That's what you want on the evening news. Yeah.
Yes, that's what you want for the lead story. While you were away, I didn't venture as far as Florida. I did venture as far as Oxford and the hallowed university because unbelievably I was invited to take part in a debate on media regulation and the role of law.
Oh, very, very Leveson-y.
It was very highbrow, and that's why they invited me, of course.
There was some terrible mix-up, sure. They wanted, Terence Stamp.
Yes. But you know what I wanted to talk about? It was fairly interesting, but you had to be there, so I'm not going to really talk very much about it, except to say that if you get a chance to hear Baroness Honora O'Neill, who is a crossbench member of the House of Lords, she was fantastic. She spoke with no notes, and she was so on top of a subject about press regulation. And she's a fascinating lady, the professor of philosophy at the University of Cambridge, a fantastic sort of life history. And I would, walk a few miles to hear her speak again. So if you ever see Baroness Honora O'Neill in your neighbourhood, go along and hear her speak. But it was a fantastic journey for me, because normally transport, south of England, just appalling. But I tested out the Oxford Park and Ride service. It was brilliant. I got from my front door to the Park and Ride place where you leave your car, free parking. Then you get this bus, £2.40 return, right into the heart of Oxford and the universities. Right. Absolutely, a bus every sort of 15 minutes, has its own bus lane, flies in, only stops 3 or 4 times. There's nothing not to like about it. It was a superb experience. It was a bit like going to, it was like a British Disney, getting the Park and Ride in Oxford.
No part of that sounds anything remotely like Disney, but...
Two little sort of snippets of sort of gossip about the day. Yeah. One I won't expand on, except to say that on the panel was Mark Stevens, CBE. He's the media lawyer that you always see, rather rotund fellow, on the steps of the High Court representing phone hacking victims. You may remember him. And I've actually mentioned him before because he represented WikiLeaks man.
Julian Assange.
Julian Assange. Yeah. In his extradition and all his various court cases all over the place, and he no longer represents Julian Assange. No. And I said to him in the lunch break, I said to him, "Why is that?" And he did tell me, but he did say he did pay me though, so he was quite happy. He said, "I'm not bothered. He paid me. Yeah. That's enough." But here's the little bit of gossip. When we were leaving, I was heading off to go back to my Park and Ride, but Mark Stevens, absolutely pleasant fact. Obviously, completely oblivious to the fact that I've made a disparaging remark about it before. He gave me a lift in his absolutely tremendous 1960s sports car. But what was amazing was we had to move his lawyer's briefcase out of the way to get me on, I could get on the seat, because it was a very tiny little sports car. And he drove me back towards the Park and Ride, and... You see this other side of people, Magnus, because you see Mark Stevens, the lawyer, on the steps of the High Court, and, we will fight for this day, so on and so forth. And in we get into his sports car, and they're banging out of his rather splendid audio system, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young.
Oh, right, I thought you were going to say Megadeth.
Oh, that would have been really great, wouldn't it? No, but it was. It sort of. I would have expected some Mozart,
right.
Or perhaps you know, some Wagner, yeah. Something like that. Yeah. But here we were, Crosby, Stills and Nash's first album, banging out of his CD player in his luxurious sports car.
Well,
a splendid fellow, gave me a lift back to the park and ride. Can't say enough about
him. I'm glad you had a good transitory experience, because Manchester Airport, from whence I flew out, have this new full body scanner system installed now. It's absolutely typically British. You know, they've invested in the technology, and I'm sure that kit doesn't come cheap. And, you know, gone to all the time and trouble of installing it. Nobody has stopped to think, what will the impact be on passenger control? Because it now takes, you know, maybe three times longer to actually get through to departures. And, so, you know, from the time I checked in, you know, usually you check in, your bags go in, and then you go through security, and then, you know, you sit around drinking coffees and, getting pretty ladies to rub aftershave on the inside of your wrist, don't you? All that kind of stuff. And but we literally arrived in departures as they called our flights, because we were in this enormous queue to go through this full body scanner. So absolutely no sort of logistical imagination got into play there at all. And in actual fact, while we're stood in this queue, people were coming through and snatching people out of the queue to go and put them on their flights, because their flights were ready to depart, which kind of defeats the object, because they then bypassed the body scanner.
Really?
Yeah, really, yeah.
That's typically British or English, yeah. I suppose, I should say, isn't it? That is just typical of our eccentricity.
It's absolutely ludicrous. The whole thing was absolutely ludicrous. So, and I think it's you know, similar to the difficulties that they've had at Heathrow that have caused so much dismay down there. And I think it was a minor version of that. But they've got to sort something out. I mean, nobody has taken the time to think, well, hold on, if we take three times longer to security check everybody, how are we going to get them to their flights? You know, ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, right. So they need a park and ride to Florida. That's what they need.
Well, it's a tremendous experience. I mean, I just kept thinking, why don't we do this in London? I know there are the pressures of space and so on. But when you drive into London on the M4, there's huge amounts of ground all around the sort of Heathrow area that's untouched.
Yeah.
And that would accommodate... Yeah. You know, such a scheme. If you could just drive in somewhere, I don't know, up somewhere between Heathrow and Hammersmith, and then get on a bus but with the understanding that it would hurtle in and not be just, you know, another hour. Yeah. But it would be so popular. Yeah. I don't know why we don't.
Well,
do
I'll tell
that.
You where it wouldn't be popular. that is the state of Florida. Is that nobody transports themselves anywhere in any other way but in their enormously oversized SUV. They wouldn't tolerate. Nobody would use it in Florida. So they are absolutely welded into their cars there.
I wouldn't hear as well. I would say, other than the fact that now we have just got so congested in our city centres, including Oxford, including London, that anything that meant that, you know, you could shave off that last hour to do 2 miles. I mean, during the week, if you're driving into London and you're going on the M4, then it becomes the A4, and you get to the bit around Brompton, Oratory, Knightsbridge, Harrods, all around there, it really can, in all seriousness, take you 45 minutes to an hour to go half a mile.
No, I can believe it.
That's an everyday occurrence. So anything that would get around that would have my vote. Last bit of news from me before we get on to reviewing stuff is last night, that's... It's Monday, the 28th, say last night, the 27th. That was a really great time. I was invited to chair the panel of judges at a live event. It's like a live X Factor thing called Melange Factor in the West End of London in Oxford Street, off Panton Street.
Melange Factor?
Melange
Factor. What does that translate as then?
Melange is like everything. Anything goes.
Oh,
everything.
Okay. Yeah.
And it was new to me, straight in chairing the judges, but I'd never been before. I hadn't do anything about it. But it basically it's a monthly event where anybody can come along and do anything, which sounds a bit like a sort of open mic or auditions, but it's not really. These are sort of professional people really looking for a break, looking to find agents or managers or record deals or whatever. And they come along, and as I say, so it's a bit auditiony, but a panel of judges, and you kind of bit X Factory as well, as you know, give your feedback, and there's marks out of five and all this sort of thing. But what I just want to say is we picked a winner at the end of it. I think there were 18 acts last night, and I was very sort of humbled by the quality, the sheer level of magnificent artists that there are around that just turn up to these things. But our winner, and I put a little link to her SoundCloud up on my Twitter feed last night, so if anybody wants to see this, but you can also find her through Google. Comfort Emmanuel is her name. Wow. And she popped up, sang a couple of songs, and only a young lady, only about 20. She's only been singing for 4 years.
Right.
And she just was actually, you know, like Louis Walsh says, you own the stage. Here, you know, it was a young lady who just came on such a tiny little thing and yet just occupied the whole room and just made the whole room go quiet, and everybody was just like, wow.
Now, you didn't say that she reminded you of the young Lenny Henry, did you?
God, no, I didn't. I did. I made sure that I avoided all of those cliches. Not once did I say, you own the stage, or, you know, the room is yours tonight, or you made that song your own. I said none of that crap, but it was enormous fun. I hope I get asked again. I maybe I won't after last night. But
yeah, maybe you failed the audition.
Yeah,
I'm sure you did.
Judges, but I'll maybe mention it again if I find it's gone up on websites or whatever. Yeah. Anyway, because I'd like other people to see how good this young lady was.
Right. Well, I'm glad you stumbled across some talent, because I guess the mortal fear is that it's a bit like the first rounds of Britain's Got Talent with people showing how they can dance with a plank of wood, or
there were one or two acts that I did kind of, I was very positive with everybody. I didn't want to slam anybody. No. I didn't feel that was my role, particularly as I was sort of in the middle as chair. Yeah. But there were one or two acts that I did say, perhaps you want to go away and have another go. Yeah. Put a bit more.
What did you get? You got a singer as the winner. Did you get magicians, impressionists, dog acts?
No. They were all singers.
Oh, yeah, okay.
To one degree or another. But there was one lady, I'm not sure if I can actually mention her name, but she was from the Netherlands. I've just found her on my list here. No, that wasn't her. No, forget the Netherlands bit. That was somebody else that needed a bit of work. But there was one particular lady, here she is, Ashira.
Right.
I won't say her surname. And she channels spirits.
This is okay.
She channeled spirits. Yeah. I've got her biog here, actually. Here we are. Been a singer for over 25 years, and she doesn't usually sing in English anymore, but says, I sing in a language to unite all languages. So she brings
Esperanto.
Spiritual...
Well, she sings in Esperanto.
You know, like the Cocteau twins used to do.
Yeah.
And Enya, and these kind of like made up languages.
Unaflode. Yeah.
Yes, it was a bit like that.
Oh, wow. Well, alternative.
It was alternative. Yeah. I did say to her that, if it had been a couple of minutes, it would have been most engaging and intriguing. Uh-huh. I let's put it this way. I wouldn't go out and buy 30 minutes of it. The lovely voice, very pure voice. It soared, Magnus. Her voice soared. But after the third, fourth, fifth minute, we began to start looking at
Was she channeling spirits? Was that her claim? Was she channeling spirits?
She was channeling spirits and translating their thoughts to her in her vocal musings, which weren't of the language that you or I might recognize.
So she was translating the messages from the spirits into complete nonsense.
Into her own language, yes, yes.
That's a rare gift, but its usefulness is questionable, I would suggest.
I did say to her, I'm not sure how you're going to build a career on this.
Okay.
Frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, on the other side of that, while you were in America, yeah. you didn't hear people soaring with spirit sounds, in this case, into the West End of London. But you did catch the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, which wasn't dissimilar to people channeling spirits. maybe not the ethereal kind, though. Yeah, I did see the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony on HBO. Yeah. Well, what an interesting thing that is. So interesting, in fact, I've written a piece about it for The Vicar, this edition.
Good.
Yeah, so...
Can I just ask you a question I'm sorry to interrupt, but I've seen it as well, and I just wanted to ask you about... what was your... Green Day and the thing, didn't they?
Yeah.
Right? And I just thought, this week, you would never get this on mainstream British TV, because starting out in the first 2 minutes... calling the audience a bunch of mother effers and telling them to raise their effing hands. I thought that was very odd, both audience participation, but also a very strange start to the show. But sorry, go.
Well, I think the reason for that is because it's on HBO, which is a cable channel and a subscription channel, then people are allowed to use profanity in America on subscription-only channels. And so the whole event was laced with rock stars grasping the free rein and letting fly with sailor talk throughout the whole thing. So
sailor talk.
Which was a bit pathetic, it's rather like saying to kids, for the next 2 hours, you can use any language you like and you won't get into trouble. So they do.
There was a sort of air of reverence I noticed, as if the inductees were being invited to enter the kingdom of heaven rather than Cleveland, Ohio.
Well, yes, exactly so. And I found the whole thing quite uncomfortable, actually. Just a sort of rock star A telling rock star B how marvellous he is. He isn't really high on my wish list of things that I want to spend a lot of time watching. And there was a lot of that, let's be fair. Also,
I was going to say
the live performances, the bands get to do a bit of a set once they've been inducted. I don't know, it's just, that fast rate. It's like the Brit Awards, you never see a band perform at their best doing a live set at the Brit Awards. It always falls flat because a band needs a bit of a run up. I think the band needs to build up a bit of a head of steam before they really start hitting their mark. And of course, you can't do that with the two tracks that you've got. And you've probably also got some blocking going on, where the director has said, at this point, I want you to step forward so this camera can catch you and everything. So you don't really get the best out of a band in that situation. And I have to say, some of the inductees just didn't look terribly pleased to be there. a doff of the cap to Anthony Kiedis from the Red Hot Chili Peppers there, who really looked like he'd got laundry to do.
In comparison to his bandmate Flea, who was
in floods of tears.
Floods of tears and thanking his mother thanking the world. As you say, the other fellow, the singer, you said his name a minute ago.
Anthony Kiedis.
Anthony Kiedis. Yeah, it did seem like he sort of interrupted other plans to drop it.
Totally, yeah.
I tell you what, though, my favourite moment was, I don't know if you saw the whole thing, but ZZ Top, they came on to induct Freddie King. But because they were both wearing hats, they were both wearing shades, and they both had enormous beards, all you could see was these two little mouths moving on stage. Yeah. It was like little puppets.
That's the top thing. I always think with ZZ Top is, how would you know if it wasn't the real ZZ Top?
No, you couldn't possibly, because you just, as I say, just see these two little sets of teeth moving barely through the beard. That's all you see of their entire faces.
You do know what those two gentlemen are called, don't you?
They're not called Beard. I know the drummer's
called
Beard.
The drummer's called Beard and he only has a moustache. The other two are Dusty Hill and Billy Gibbons, which are legendary names with a legendary look going on there. Yeah, yeah. And
Wasn't it great when Freddie King's daughter came on, I thought she just gave this... She did give a magnificent speech, and I just thought, this is the difference between America and British education systems and schoolings. Almost every American can step up to a microphone and speak with authority and ease.
They absolutely can, yes, yes. An eloquent culture there. It's, people can always... I think it's because they have no... or have a smaller degree of self-consciousness than the British do. And we're riddled with self-doubt and self-consciousness. And the Americans have absolute confidence. So you see commercials in America where customers are giving Vox Pops and, they're as good as the guy anchoring the commercial. You know?
So, yeah, they get it straight away, don't they? They hit the ground running and they get what they're there to do and what to say. Yeah. Whereas British people either run away or giggle or start waving and going...
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, the Americans are very good at that. So. But in the piece, and I shan't reiterate what I've written in the piece.
Okay.
In the piece I've written, I question the whole necessity of a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because I've an absolute conviction that it's utterly unnecessary, and actually begins to undermine the whole reason that we like pop and rock music in the first place. But you can see why when you read the piece. Yeah.
Okay, here's the thing. We'll move on from the actual show, but here's the thing, highlighting my incredible naivety. I thought, until I checked this today, that it was an imaginary, a notional Hall of Fame that, you know, people just sort of were theoretically inducted to, but it actually exists. Yeah. There's a huge building.
There is, in Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah, that's the museum, isn't it? Yeah, that's... Yeah, there is a sort of hall. I don't think you have to go and live in it.
You don't have to go and live in it. You can go in. I've just discovered today. I was just looking it up before we started today that you for $22, but there is a discount if you're a Cleveland resident.
Oh, yeah.
You only have to pay $16. Yes, they have permanent exhibits and exhibits that move around rather like the Tate Modern or something over here.
Yeah, yeah.
But they have a permanent. I now want to go because they have a permanent Beatles exhibit. With 70 artifacts, which vary from George Harrison's striped suit from the 1966 US tour, the coat that Ringo wore in Strawberry Fields Forever promo. Right down to a page from Stuart Sutcliffe's sketch pad.
Right.
But 70 items of Beatles only.
Yeah, I'm enormously unkeen on these kind of displays of rock memorabilia because I just think, you're looking at them as objects which weren't significant at the time. And which is presumably how the museum got hold of them. And they're completely out of context. I mean, they were never intended to be viewed under glass in a museum. Ringo's coat was presumably, at its most creative there to make the video look good and at its most prosaic to keep him warm. So I don't see why it would take on enormous significance seeing it under glass in some kind of display case. So, that's, I mean, what else are you going to put in a Hall of Fame? Which brings me back to my questioning the necessity for a rock and roll.
I'll tell you what else we'll have in this Hall of Fame. My last bit on this is in the car park at the moment, and you can actually go in and see this. It reopened on May the 21st. Any American or Cleveland residents would be pleased to know the Johnny Cash tour bus, and you can have a tour
Of
the
tour
Johnny
bus,
Cash tour bus. And it includes June Cash's blue velour upholstered furniture,
right.
And you can see the table in Johnny Cash's personal compartment that was built of wood salvaged near Cash's birthplace.
Right. See, this is all nonsense, This is all just enormously tenuous, It's like, I think genuinely auctioned once was a piece of toast which George Harrison ordered but didn't eat. clearly he didn't eat it. Otherwise, they'd be auctioning something that didn't look like toast. But George Harrison ordered it, but he didn't want it. And now you want $500 for somebody to buy it. I don't get all that. I just don't get all that at all. I can see how, the handwritten lyrics for Hey Jude have some kind of poetic currency. But when you get down to, you know, Johnny Cash's tour bus.
if you were to go at the moment as well, in the main exhibit hall in the Legends of Rock area, you can see Peter Gabriel's leather jacket from when he was in Genesis.
Yeah, you see, you know, this is just rubbish.
It is, isn't it? In fact, we would say no jacket required.
Yes. There's a huge multi-layered Genesis solo act thing going on there, isn't there? So, I just don't buy into that. I mean, that's a really, really nonsense. And how would you know if you were looking at something that they just bought from Walmart? You know, you just wouldn't, would you? You know?
You really would.
In much the same way as you wouldn't know you were looking at an artificial ZZ Top. You wouldn't.
No, it could be anybody's little mouth.
It could be anybody's leather jacket that you're looking at there. So I don't really get hung up on all that kind of, you know, rock memorabilia stuff. I mean, I've got a handwritten postcard that Kirk Brandon from Spear of Destiny sent to me whilst he was on tour. Maybe I should send that over to Cleveland and they could put it.
I think they'd snatch that up. And indeed, if you were on the Antiques roadshow they'd be saying, now, you know, the insurance value of this is quite considerable. I hope you've got it insured. I would put a value of £100,000 on this Kirk Brandon postcard.
I think that's fair. I mean, I think that's far more enthralling than Peter Gabriel's leather jacket, I have to say.
Well, you didn't go to Cleveland, Ohio in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but you did go to the movie theatre.
I did go to the movies. First of all, I've got to tell you about the cinema, which is when you review a movie that you've seen in the UK, there's very little to be said about the cinema, except that it was probably fairly dire experience where you had to buy an overpriced ticket from the same guy who sells the popcorn and Kiora. But this was entirely different because I went to see this movie at Downtown Disney. Now, for those of you who aren't Disney aficionados, Downtown Disney is the bit of the park that you can visit for free. Has a small fun fair, but mainly it is restaurants, bars, and shops. It looks absolutely like the rest of the theme park, but you can just park and go into that bit. And then, of course, as you might expect, they have a cinema there. And it is, and now this is, we would call it a dinner cinema, I suppose. The Americans call it fork and screen, they call it.
Oh, wow.
So you go into the cinema.
I like it already.
Yeah, you would love it. Yeah, you go into the cinema. First of all, the most comfortable cinema seats you will ever sit in.
I'd fall asleep. You see, that would be no good for me.
I know. Especially with the intense humidity outside. It's air-conned inside. But the seats are like, you know, 10 Parkinol recliners all bolted together. Absolutely fabulous. In front of you, there's a ledge, an extended ledge. And on there is a menu. And before the film starts, a waitress comes around and asks what you'd like to order. And you can have, you know, pizza, nachos, you name it, really, chicken stuff and everything. And then just as the movie's starting, your drinks and meals are brought to you.
Oh, fantastic.
Placed on the ledge and you can munch your way through the movie in this huge leather seat, which is really, really good. $14, that's not bad, is it?
$14. That's not bad at all. Yeah. You know, again, over here, that would be £114.
Yeah,
pounds.
I mean, plus your food. You know, you have to pay for your food at the end. You know, but to go in and access this facility, $14. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Doesn't include the food.
No, you have to buy the food as well. But
But it sounds fantastic. Yeah, we should have that here. See, that would get people out into the cinemas, wouldn't it? That really would.
Yeah, fork and screen. It's the American concept. So anyway, we did all this, and the film we went to see was The Dictator.
And I want to ask you a question. Oh, yet again, I'm interrupting your
flow.
I'm really
all right.
Sorry, but I want to ask you a question because, again, I'm not going to steal your thunder. I've seen this in a preview theatre, movie theatre here last week, and there was just one bit where the very small audience I watched it with had a sharp intake of breath.
Right.
And I just want to check with you what the American audience's reaction was to the very dangerous ground of 9/11 gags in the helicopter. I know we probably better not give a spoiler or anything, but there were gags about 9/11, and it was really quite sort of surreal, a little bit dodgy.
Yeah.
And as I say, over here, the reaction in the movie theatre with professional film reviewers was...
Ooh. Oh, really? Okay.
So what was the reaction in America to some of these gags, but particularly the more rather dubious taste ones about 9/11?
The 9/11 stuff, I mean, they swallowed it whole, really. Didn't seem to be any sort of problem. It raised a few laughs from American people in the auditorium. I think to an extent the Americans have reached a watershed with 9/11 where it is not fair game to be laughed at, but certainly they've come to terms with what's happened, especially with Bin Laden no longer being with us. I think they feel there's some closure there. And, obviously America is an enormously patriotic country, and that's true in every state. But I think we underestimate their ability to laugh at themselves. I think we think Americans are very sort of single-minded and very, very stars and stripes and salute the flag, but I think they can laugh at themselves pretty well as well. There wasn't a problem at all in the showing that I went to. Whether that would be the case in New York is a different matter. Sure. But
what did you make of it anyway?
I think Sacha Baron Cohen has done a Ricky Gervais in that after a string of very groundbreaking and more importantly hilarious movies from my point of view, he's started to believe his own press and he's got very flabby and lazy. I thought there was a good film trying to get out of this. I think they'd bought the script at least three rewrites too early. It could have been much funnier. I would have liked the opportunity to have sat down with the script and fine-tuned it, because I mean, I'm no comedy writer, but I could see many and the scene that you're talking about in the helicopter was one such scene. It was a good gag lazily constructed, and there were a lot of those. There are a lot of those throughout the film where you think, ah, this is going to be funny. Oh no, it's not. Too many obvious things, too many sort of obscene gags. Well, nothing wrong with obscene gags, but too many shoehorned in just because somebody seemed to have thought of them. They didn't tie in with the plot in any sort of way. And not enough of them hilariously funny. The observations of the Middle Eastern politics and American politics were just way too obvious. It didn't give you that aha feeling, you know. It's like, ah, good point, that, you know, good point funnily made. There wasn't enough of that. It was too crass, too obvious, and I suppose constricted for the American market, because the Americans do like obvious humor. They're not keen on the irony. But I think with Bruno, his previous film, and Borat, the one before that, they were heavy with irony. There was a lot of knowing stuff going on. This wasn't particularly knowing. This was very slapstick, very obvious, and just a bit beneath Baron Cohen's obvious creative abilities. But he did this with Ali G. He made the Ali G movie, and it was catastrophically poor, and then went on to do two really, really funny films. So, you know, I hope this is just another dip, because I do like Sacha Baron Cohen, and I think his sense of timing, humour, and the ability to make sharp points in a very funny way still exist, but I don't think he's put them into this film at all. Nothing like as funny as it should have been.
Not a great sort of storyline to it, is there really? I felt it was more a series of sketches an opportunity to throw in some one-liners. One or two. I was kind of thinking I wouldn't enjoy it. It wasn't something that I would sort of particularly recommend, but I didn't hate it. I enjoyed some of the one-liners, particularly one that I made a note of that I thought was quite clever. He goes in his Middle Eastern potentate role.
Yes.
He goes into this hotel in America, yes. And he says $20 a day for internet access, yes. And they accuse me of being an international
yes,
criminal.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, yeah. There's some
which would strike home.
Well, yes.
Wouldn't it strike home to anybody who's ever been in a hotel anywhere around the world where they always want to fleece you for having access to the internet? Yeah.
No, that's absolutely right. There are some nice moments. I mean, what you could have done with is an editor to go through and highlight the nice moments and bring everything else up to that level. I mean, seeing the becostumed Baron Cohen squashing his willy against a window is fun. Oh, is only funny if you're five, isn't it? And it was just like, oh, we'll sling that in there. And it really needed somebody to say, you don't need that scene. It's not funny enough, you know, but it was in there. And that was the problem. I think, there was a fairly sharp comedy film bursting to get out, but it was too waylaid with weak writing and weak humour, I think. Just disappointing, really. It wasn't a catastrophe, but it was disappointing compared with Bruno, where now this is all subjective, but watching Bruno, I thought they were going to have to call the paramedics to me, because I thought I was going to burst something laughing at some of the scenes in Bruno. And this didn't do that, which was a shame, really. The big political message at the end about,
no spoilers, Magnus.
No,
no spoilers.
There's a point he makes about supposed democracies, which is so clunky as to give you a headache, really. Yeah, yeah. And
I was going to say the ending is, and again, we won't say how it ends, but you could imagine that it was written by a committee who said, "Now we've got to make the ending appeal to, the middle American audience."
Yeah.
So let's get a focus group and a committee in to write.
Which is the problem with Hollywood, really? Yeah, yeah. So I think, he's got to up his game for his next shot at it. But when it comes around on DVD or on demand, it's probably worth eating a pizza too on a Saturday evening, but not much more than that.
Yeah. I didn't want to enjoy the bit where he was playing Wee Terrorist. But for some reason that appealed to me. It was one of those little, Xbox Wii machine.
Yeah.
Wee Terrorist. Yeah.
Some of that was quite nice. I think, he started to go in directions that were quite appealing, that you think, oh yeah, that's clever, that's inventive, but they were too far and few between, or few and far between. Yeah, yeah, they were.
So what, is it getting two thumbs up, one thumb up, or sort of like no thumbs?
I think, when in the gladiator arena, when the emperor's thumb was wobbling on a sort of horizontal plane, I think I'll go there. Yeah.
So that's Sacha Baron Cohen's The Dictator. When is it out over here? I've no idea.
Here. Yeah, I think.
Oh,
yeah,
is it?
I think,
oh, it's out already.
It's out
okay.
Already. Yeah. Oh yes, I've got it here actually. It came out 16th of May.
Perhaps have already seen it or on their way to see it. Cool.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now it's unbelievably back to shore. Time has come round once again for your pretend iPod.
Oh, good grief. And it's been so long, it flees from my mind as to who's going first.
I hear from our huge production team that as you've picked first for the last two occasions we have met, then they've said to me, it's time, Dacom, that you went first.
Well,
so
who am I to argue with the behind-the-scenes crew?
Absolutely, yeah. They're not to be argued with. Now, despite what some information websites say, Wikipedia.
Other information websites are... Oh, no, they're not. Yes. No,
they're not really, are they? No. Laura Nero wrote the song that I'm bringing to us this week when she was about 14 or 15. It was originally a rather complex suite of music with many changes of direction, but we know the poppy 2 minute 42 seconds version.
Okay.
The wonderfully chirpy plea to an imaginary boyfriend to name the wedding day, thus preempting Beyonce's Single Ladies by 45 years, though, because if you liked it, then you should have put a ring on it. It's perhaps a touch more graphic than Laura Nero's in your voice I hear a choir of carousels, but where am I ever going to hear my wedding bells? I love this song. Wedding Bell Blues, number one on the US Billboard charts in 1969, not for Laura Nero, but for the Fifth Dimension, who actually built a career on covering Laura Nero's songs.
Yeah, they did the same Fifth Dimension who did The Age of Aquarius, the same
mob.
Yes,
very same Fifth Dimension. And naturally on their version of Wedding Bell Blues, who steps along on drums? Our old friend Hal Blaine.
Oh, there's no getting away from that fella.
There really isn't almost any hit in America in the 1960s, and you click on personnel and you go to drums, it's going to say Hal Blaine.
Well, is he in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, we have to ask?
What a good question. I think we would check on that. I think when hopefully I can check that before we finish. So that's a really good question. He should be. Laura Nero, I've written about her for this week's Rocking Vickers, so you can read a bit more about how I view Laura in that piece. But a very private woman who didn't play the fame game, and she died aged only 49 in 1997. Really enigmatic figure, Laura Nero. I compare her most to Todd Rundgren, who every time that they appear that they're going to get a breakthrough, that suddenly the world is catching up with them, they took a different direction and went down a different path. And she was absolutely, totally unbothered with becoming famous, making lots of money. Indeed, the last, 20 years of her life, she was largely living on the royalties from those early first hits that she wrote for so many other artists. However, I bring to your attention, it'll be on the pretend iPod, and you'll hear a little snatch of it at the end of the podcast today. My pick for the pretend iPod this week is Laura Nero and Wedding Bell Blues.
Terrific. It's a good choice. Do you know what is absolutely... Well, it's absolutely astonishing. You'll be the judge of this. But for my entire adult life, and probably before it, I've always thought her name was Laura Nero.
Well, yeah, well, one would. But yes. She actually... It's a story to this, actually, because her real name, handed down by her parents, of course, her birth name, Laura Negro.
Oh, right. Okay.
And N-I-G-R-O.
Yeah.
And of course, in the 1960s, that's going to get her much of a career. Indeed. When on the radio, people would say, "Here's the latest from Laura Negro."
Yes, careful. Yes,
I know, and it was pronounced that way as well.
Yeah.
So she actually, in getting her first recording contract, went through a variety of names, and one can actually find her referred to in all different variations around. So although one would look at it with the Y and think Nero, it's the nearest to Negro that she could get. Okay, so it's Laura Nero.
Well, now we know. Laura Nero. I shall make sure I get that right in future. Well, thanks for that pick. Now, I'm going to lead you to my pick in a sort of cryptic fashion. I'm going to, like a knockout competition. First of all, I want you to name me a male soul singer. Any male soul singer.
Any male soul. Marvin Gaye.
Okay, Marvin Gaye. Now name me a male soul singer who used to be a stage magician.
Ooh. Male soul singer. Now you've got.
Yeah.
Now I'm. I'm going
to
struggle.
That's how quickly we can narrow it down to Timothy E. Thomas, better known to the world as Timmy Thomas.
Okay.
Yeah. Now he's. And if I say he was a B-list soul singer, I only mean in terms of profile and fame, because some of those lesser known soul singers were easily the equal of the Marvin Gaye's, as you mentioned, and Smokey Robinson's, and et al., and Levi Stubbs, and all the rest of them. I mean, for one, there's our friend here, Timmy Thomas, and also, now who's the lovely day fella? Who sang Lovely Day?
Oh, Lovely Day, Bill Withers.
Yeah, sorry, thank you very much. That's what I'm struggling with. Bill Withers. Yeah. Also, absolutely tremendous artist, and Lovely Day doesn't do him justice. But Timmy Thomas was one of those guys, a soul singer in the 70s, who really, I mean, he did have several hits in the US, but only one real significant hit. But it's such a good record that it really should have put him up there with Smokey and Marvin and all the rest of them. And the song is Why Can't We Live Together? And anybody who doesn't know the record, it's worth seeking out, if for no other reason than if you want to hear the Hammond organ deployed to its highest potential, then this record is completely built around a Hammond organ sound. Really, the only instruments you can pick out there are the drums and the Hammond organ, and then Timmy singing over the top. He takes his time over this record. It's a very languid record. Indeed, the drums and Hammond organ at the beginning make you wonder if anybody's actually going to turn up to sing, but eventually he does. But that, I like that about it. It's quite a hypnotic record. It draws you in slowly and steadily till your sort of head's lolling from side to side. And then Timmy comes in. He's got a wonderful voice. Quite why he wasn't more successful, I don't know. Perhaps, you know, some of his other records aren't as good as this one, but they're certainly good enough to have made him a star. But he was never the biggest star in soul music. And I didn't come across him at all until Sade's Diamond Life album, on which the closing track is her version of Why Can't We Live Together, which is always my favourite track on Diamond Life. And then I went back and discovered the original, and it blows the Sade version out of the water, I have to say. It's really the signature song of a guy who should have been more famous, who was definitely the equal of his more famous contemporaries, and he was Timmy Thomas, and the song is Why Can't We Live Together, released in 1972. And I would urge everybody to go and have a listen to that.
I would too. Very unusual song, as you say. And, yes, it kind of drifts out of our memory. I'm glad you brought it back to us. I just want to jump in before you do the wind-up, because obviously people will be on the edge of their seats on that Hal Blaine question. I'm delighted to report that in March 2000, Hal Blaine was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for his fantastic drumming legacy. Well done, Hal. Yeah. Well done. You know, I'm obsessed with Hal Blaine and the records he's played on, but there's an absolutely amazing record that he's got, because the Grammy Awards have a category, the record of the year, and Hal Blaine played on 6 consecutive years worth of record of the year Grammy Award winners, which are absolutely remarkable when you think that, you know, by sheer sheer amount of work that he undertook, that he managed that. And it went from 66, Herb Alpert, Taste of Honey, Frank Sinatra, wait for this, wait, what a list this is, by the way, Frank Sinatra in 67 for Strangers in the Night, 68, funnily enough, The Fifth Dimension and Up and Away.
Oh, In My Beautiful Balloon, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Burt Bacharach, I think. Simon and Garfunkel in 69, Mrs. Robinson.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Back again with The Fifth Dimension in 1974, Aquarius and Let the Sunshine In, as again mentioned earlier. Yeah. And finally, his run of 6, 1971, wait for this, Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Wow, yeah, yeah.
What a run. 6 years in a row, every Grammy Award winning record of the year, Hal Blaine played drums
But if you said to even some top music aficionados, what links Sinatra's Stranger in the Night with Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water, we'd struggle to make the link, wouldn't we?
Does strike me as remarkable today that, apart from essentially me going on about it on various podcasts and various columns, to say Hal Who.
Yeah.
I just urge anybody, I mean, in this particular case, I would say, please do feel free to go to Wikipedia, because if you just look up Hal Blaine in Wikipedia, if it will astonish you, the records that this man played on. And indeed, in fact, Wikipedia lists only the number one hits that he played on.
Right.
And you can't fit them on to one screen.
Amazing, amazing.
You really can't. It goes from Good Vibrations through The Way We Were, through The Carpenters, back to He's a Rebel by The Crystals in 1962. It's absolutely
incredible. Yeah, it doesn't seem fair, does it, really, that one man should contribute to so many landmark records. But great.
So hits, yeah. The hits, as they say, Magnus Shaw, the hits keep on coming.
Yeah, Hal Blaine, excellent stuff. And I should just mention, on the subject of Timmy Thomas, what inspired me to pick it is that Why Can't We Live Together was recorded in Florida, which is what gave me brought that track to mind on my return for the podcast. And on that, we shall draw to a close for the podcast for this edition. Thank you very much, sir, for your input, and your lively banter. Wit and other attributes, and yes, we shall look forward to bringing them all back again in 7 days' time. Thank you very much to you for listening at home. We're very glad that you managed to, and as I say, we'll do it all again. Well, probably sooner than 7 days' time, actually, because there'll be a vicar next weekend. So we'll see you in about 5 days' time, something like that. Thanks very much for listening. We look forward to your company again. For now, bye bye.
Listening to a Dacom Shore media production.